Hello and welcome to the latest ASI cast. I'm Richard Marks, ASI's Research Director. I think in about the 180 or so episodes we've done, the guest who's accumulated the most frequent flyer points is Guy Bisson from Ampere Analysis, who's been giving us regular insights since 2016 when Ampere was just 2 years old and it's now very well established. So welcome back to the podcast, Guy.
Thank you, Richard.
Now, regular listeners should know that you've been in LA at the heart of the US entertainment industry for the last few years. You're now back in the UK, so perhaps able to reflect back on that experience. Has being in LA changed your perspective on the entertainment industry and TV and streaming in particular?
I don't think it's changed my perspective. It was certainly a interesting time to be out in LA. I went out just as the pandemic was coming to an end and restrictions were beginning to be lifted. And shortly after that, within a year, Netflix had its first wobble when it lost a fairly significant number of customers and really began to pull back on content investment. And that was towards the end of 2022. And that really was the first point that kicked off the trend that we've been living through ever since, which is the declining rate of growth in content investment. So coming off a very extended period of almost exponential growth in content investment, suddenly slowing that right down to a crawl. And since then, we've seen a pullback again. Then in 23, of course, we had the Hollywood strikes and a great rarity to have a strike full stop, but to have both actors and writers on strike at the same time is incredibly unusual. So there was that tumultuous time. And then since then, we've gone into another slowdown. So it was an interesting 3 years to be out in the heart of the industry because, of course, there were huge job losses in Hollywood, huge cutbacks, lots of things going on that were pretty unique and really a once in a generation occurrence. And all of that went on in that short 3 years.
Because you also had the, I can't remember now, it's all a bit of a blur, but the gap between the final end of COVID and the writer's strike wasn't that big. And you had at least 2 or 3 years where certainly a lot of the network shows were having full shortened seasons. So it wasn't just the cutback in investment, but a limit in what could actually be produced, whether it was the ability to stand in the same room together to act, or then the availability of scripts or actors.
Yes, certainly all sorts of changes occurred during COVID. Of course, it was a boom time for the streaming business, perhaps counterintuitively, because everyone was at home. The streaming business did very well out of it, but then it had to pay its dues after the pandemic, because what they referred to at the time as carry forward, which was growth that would have occurred further in the future, happened during the pandemic. That was another issue they were dealing with right at that end of the pandemic and saturation and slowdown in their customer acquisition rates, which also impacted the whole industry. So really kicking off, as I say, the latest sort of wave that we're living through right now occurred over that 3 years post-pandemic. And it's really set the agenda for where we find ourselves now.
There's a danger of being in a bit of a chicken and egg situation, I guess. But I think one of the things we did discuss a while back was whether the writers and actors strike might actually not have been a bad thing for the streamers in the sense that they were already contemplating having to cut back expenditure on content as the growth was slowing post-pandemic. And it didn't exactly give them an excuse to do it, but it was coming at a time at which they probably would have been cutting back anyway.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And certainly there were rumors in LA at the time that they were not in a hurry to negotiate terms for that very reason, that they were saving money on content production. And we saw during that strike period that many of the streaming operations generated a small profit and certainly had vastly improved cash flow. And I think maybe going too far to say it showed them the road to profitability, because I'm sure they knew how to get there all along, but it certainly showed them that by cutting back on the rate of growth of content spend, they could much more rapidly reach profitability, which was increasingly being called for by investors. And now many of them are turning a profit on a quarterly basis. So we have seen a complete change since, well, just in the last 12 months in terms of the financial profile of particularly the studio streamers.
When you say that they're turning a profit, obviously you're talking about the, Netflix and Disney and some of the larger, what you might term pure play operators. How do we evaluate the profitability of Apple or Amazon, because they're just so embedded into the core business, aren't they? I assume both are still, if they were isolated, both Apple and Prime would be loss leaders, or are they self-sufficient in their own right?
Well, I don't think we have the visibility on the finances, as you say, because it's all part of a much larger operation to determine how profitable just the video part of the business is. I mean, certainly Amazon talks about, I think their view of it has evolved slightly, that it absolutely was a way to bring on high spending retail customers at the beginning. But the way they talk about it now is certainly that it's standing on its own two feet. People subscribe to Prime not for the retail, but actually for the video. Obviously, not everyone, but there's a notable number of customers, according to Amazon, who are coming because of the video, not because of the retail. Where, of course, for several years, it was completely the other way around. It was almost incidental that you got the video access.
And Apple's a still a bit of a holdout in that they are, to my knowledge, the only major platform that doesn't have an ad tier, or doesn't seem to have been talking about having an ad tier. Do you think that's just part of their DNA, or could you see that happening at some point in the future?
Well, to me, it is part of their DNA as a premium brand. But then I said Netflix would never launch an ad tier. So probably I'm not the right person to ask. The rumors, again, are that because as they move more into sport, advertising would start to make more sense, at least around some of the sport content. But to me, they will remain the standout because of that. Not obsession, but it's certainly, as you say, part of their DNA to be a premium brand, and advertising doesn't always align fully with that kind of self view.
They always seem to have gone more for the quality rather than the quantity approach, and had that, one or two really big talked about shows as opposed to the volume. I mean, we had Ted Lasso, then Slow Horses, and more recently Severance seems to be a huge hit in terms of sort of media coverage, if not necessarily audience. But it's an interesting approach, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely their approach. And it is interesting when you talk to people who are subscribers and viewers, they seem to genuinely value that approach. If you look at the numbers and the data, obviously their library, their catalog is very, very small. They've passed on opportunities to acquire operations like, for example, MGM. Whereas they could obviously well afford to have acquired MGM and probably others, and they haven't done that. So it's clearly part of their strategy to remain focused in on very high production value, top-tier talent, great writers, and quality over quantity.
Now, you talked about in the past the concept of peak TV. And as we were discussing earlier in the conversation, the theory is that to a certain degree, the the writer's strike, the pandemic, the economic reality setting in with the streamers seems to have brought that period to a close. But more recently, you have been talking about a new phase called 75% peak TV. Can you expand on what that is?
Yeah, sure. It was a piece of luck, really, when I was drilling into the latest data. The early part of the year, we got in the year-end figures for 24, so we had that full span of data, and of course the historic data. When you look at the chart, there's a very obvious drop and flattening through about 8 quarters, and if you compare that 8 quarters to the 8 quarters before, when we were at the peak of production volume, the difference is 25%. So they're down 25% pretty consistently off the peak. And that's what I mean by 75% peak TV. But more interesting than the fact it's 25% down is that it's been consistently 25% down for about 8 quarters. And what that suggests to me is that we've reached a new steady state. It's not a temporary fluctuation. It's the new level at which the studios, Netflix and others, have said, we've learned this is the sustainable volume of investment in content, happens to be 25% off peak. We're going to stick there. And to me, that's the more interesting part of that 75%, the fact that it's been so stable now for so many quarters since the turmoil of the strike.
Is that also the phenomenon, not just that we're talking about volume, but also potentially, I don't want to say quality, because that implies producing sort of rubbish TV, but in terms of the actual cost of the programming that's being produced, I was kind of wondering in the last few years whether we're starting to almost see, for example, on Netflix, a new type of Netflix show. If you take a couple of examples like The Night Agent and The Lincoln Lawyer, they don't have major existing stars as their leads. They're quite traditional, American network type shows of procedurals shot around, Los Angeles or New York, using, without massive alien planets to recreate or big special effects budgets, and also tending to be fairly safe with a 15 rating, an odd bit of swearing that you can cut out for overseas markets when you dub it. But other than that, being almost effectively, the network TV we used to see in the 90s. So presumably that 75% that is being produced might also be more affordable than when they were writing blank checks to Woody Allen to go away and produce something, and him coming back a couple of years later and giving them the money back, saying he couldn't think of anything.
Well, interestingly, the spend is not down. It's flat. So what that suggests is the costs are still going up, and that was obviously a long-term issue. And one of the reasons we're seeing more and more production move outside of the US. But I think the wider trend there is something that I've been calling for some time now, broadcastification of streaming. And that is driven to a large degree by the adoption of advertising. So, using the Netflix example, what we've seen is, of course, more unscripted, so reality TV and light entertainment coming on platform, but also the types of show that one wants when you have advertising are different from when you're a premium subscription platform, and the procedural. And crime is the one growth area in that downturn that we were talking about earlier. So more and more money is going into crime. Crime procedurals work brilliantly for bringing people back week after week, rather than that explosive drop of maybe 8 episodes of a high-end production. A longer-running procedural gets people coming back, and you drop it weekly, and that's good for two things. One is retention of customers, which is increasingly important, and the other is advertising, regularity of engagement with the platform, which is good for advertisers. So that is what's happening in the entertainment and TV part of the space. But of course, sport investment is the other part of that story. And again, it brings Netflix increasingly into competition with traditional broadcasters and traditional pay television platforms that have always used sport as a key part of their schedule.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about sport because you issue a very helpful weekly email newsletter that both Mike and I subscribe to, and we both remarked in the last couple of months that more and more of the news items do relate to sports acquisitions, sports rights, DAZN, etc. Where do you think we're headed in the long term? Because presumably, broadcast-based listeners listening to this podcast, should they be worried? Because that recently, someone was saying to me that really the thing they thought would keep regional broadcasters going was access to sports rights.
Yes, and as I say, that's part of what I'm calling broadcastification of streaming. Should they be worried? Yes, because if you look at the numbers, streamers at the moment are spending about between 13 and 17% of their content budgets on sport. Sounds actually quite a lot, but if you look at broadcasters, they spend around 35% of their budgets on sport. And pay TV platforms spend around 55% of their budgets on sport. So if you think of that as the ceiling where streaming might be heading, there's a potential huge amount of money still to go into the market from the streamers, and they will take the rights that have traditionally gone to pay TV and to broadcast. And obviously, we've seen recently DAZN agreed to acquire Foxtel in Australia, for example, which is the sort of Sky equivalent over there in Australia, also owner of a streaming sports platform called Kayo. So that crossover between streaming and more traditional pay TV, which is now beginning to embrace M&A activity, is something we're going to see more and more of. It's another phrase I've termed recently that I call diagonal integration, because traditionally we've thought about the media industry in a very horizontal or vertical way. But whether it was horizontal or vertical, it was about integration in quite a linear fashion. So, and that linear fashion followed the exploitation chain of content. So you integrated channels with distribution, which was in the old days cable systems, and you integrated production with channels. So that very linear way of thinking is no longer fit for purpose. We now need to think diagonally, and that means across different ecosystems, which would mean streaming plus traditional, social media plus streaming, and all sorts of other integrations that are not about the pathway that content follows in its monetization chain, because everyone has converged on the same space. And that space is streaming distribution effectively within the same exploitation window. And that's why we're increasingly seeing social media butt heads with the likes of Netflix, with the likes of ITV, the BBC, and traditional broadcasters, and of course with Sky and others.
In terms of, it's interesting you talk about the diagonalization of the approach, because one of the other things that we were talking about a while back was the sort of vertical integration that the studios were, like Disney were looking at, where you would, make your own show, have your own production studio, produce the show, and put it out exclusively on your streaming service. So effectively, every step of the chain from the creation of the show to the exploitation of it would be done on your own platform. That, as we've discussed, has started to break down as the need to make money means that certainly companies like Disney are now licensing shows on other platforms. But in terms of sports, I was intrigued a couple of years ago when FIFA started to talk about launching their own streaming service and whether one possible direction of travel, taking the Premier League, for example, might be that rather than doing a complex pattern of overseas deals or, selling all their rights to Netflix, they just set up Premier League Plus as one stop for the whole world, 20 quid a month, giving you Premier League games, whether you're in, Dublin or Dubai. I don't know. Do you think there's any likelihood of the actual leagues themselves, the sports rights owners, effectively cutting out even the middleman of the streamer and just going direct to market? Or is that just too risky for them?
My gut feeling says it's too risky, and we've seen historically, not necessarily leagues setting up on their own, but when a new buyer comes in fresh and takes the rights off an established owner, that they find it very, very hard to build from a standing start the levels of customers quickly enough to justify the cost of the rights, certainly when we're talking about high-value domestic rights. Where there's more opportunity to do something like that is with a high value sport, say Premier League, which is highly valuable in the UK, less valuable outside the UK, and take just the international and do something around a single point of access outside the key most valuable market for those rights. So I think we'll start to see that sort of experimentation, but going full bore. As the only option being your own platform to sell the rights, I think it's probably early days for that, and a real challenge to make this, because the rights are so expensive and so valuable, that would be a real challenge from a standing start.
Yeah, you'd have to dislocate yourselves from dozens of local deals, I guess, over time. So even scheduling it would be tricky. But I mean, I think certainly there is more and more talk about the linear element of streaming, which is, as Mike and I discussed at various times and cropped up at our recent conference, that does make it all the more important we get our terminology right when people talk about people moving from linear to streaming, when streaming, as we've been discussing, an increasing proportion of it is going to be linear content as opposed to just on-demand content. So I think that's certainly something to bear in mind. But obviously, to go back in history, that this all really came about with people's focus on Netflix as the canary in the coal mine for the whole growth of the streaming era. And over the years, there's been various talk about, well, Netflix being acquired by different companies, but they still seem to be proudly independent. And a couple of weeks ago, Evan Shapiro, who has been a guest on our show, said at a conference that, and I quote, "The streaming wars are over. Netflix has won. Biggest subscription channel on the face of the earth, the only one that's truly profitable from a big streaming standpoint." Would you agree with his analysis?
Well, I think it's stating the obvious that Netflix is by far the biggest streamer. It's the foundation service in households when one thinks about streaming. But to suggest that it's won somehow, I think it is incorrect. Netflix has a 13-year head start on everyone else. It was an absolute pioneer of streaming. It effectively invented the market. The other streamers, the studio streamers in particular, didn't really enter till around 2020. So they're quite early in their development. That head start has positioned them, as I say, as the foundation service upon which other services are added into the household bundle. And as a result, they are the largest. They are making money. They set the agenda in many, many ways. What Netflix does, others follow. But I can't see a situation long term or even shorter medium term where there is a single streamer completely dominating the market, a monoculture. I mean, it would be completely unsustainable for a start. The volume of content you'd need to do that would be huge. And the other streamers play an important role in the wider entertainment mix. They all have their own flavors. They all add additional content and features and interest and different sports and different types of entertainment. It's just that they're at a much earlier stage of their development. But as they now become profitable, we'll see them continue to build market share. They're not going to, make Netflix shrink away, but they certainly, there is a place in the market for all of those other streamers. So I think it's not right to say that one streamer has won. One streamer is vastly ahead by virtue of having started many, many years before anyone else. But there's no war that's been won, in my view.
No, I mean, not for this particular discussion, but obviously YouTube dominates the market in terms of sort of, ad-supported free streaming as a platform, and Evan's involved in a lot of conversations about whether, broadcasters should be leaning into that. But I tend to agree that in the subscription area, it's unlikely that one platform is going to dominate to the degree that YouTube almost is the generic for that sort of thing in its area of operation. So be interesting to see how that pans out. But I guess in the meantime, just as a final thought, it's always a tricky question, and we've talked to about some past predictions, but what's your expect what do you think are going to be the potentially the big things to look for this year, this coming year in the world of streaming? What big trends do you think are on the horizon? You've mentioned the things settling down at 75% peak TV, but are we looking at any potential acquisitions or major game changes coming?
Yeah, I think this trend of diagonal integration is what we'll start to see, and you arguably DAZN Foxtel is an example of that. You mentioned YouTube. Collaborations with YouTube again going to be increasingly important as we move forward. I would argue YouTube is a global distribution platform, an ad sales platform, and sits in a very different ecosystem from Netflix and others. But there's potential to leverage the things it does very well through collaboration and through M&A activity, not suggesting that YouTube will be the target of M&A, but there are other social platforms that could be. So that across ecosystem diagonal integration, I think, will become increasingly common. We've seen the first few deals already, and that's going to set the agenda going forward.
Well, thanks for catching up with us today. It's good to have you back in the UK. Judging by the timing of when you left, I think your timing was perfect in terms of being back in the UK and not in the interesting times that are happening in America at the moment. I know you weren't able to make our last event, our annual conference, but I think you're planning to be with us in Copenhagen on the 5th to the 7th of November this year, which we a couple of weeks ago unveiled is the our new destination for this year. So hope to catch up with you there. I'm sure we'll catch up on the podcast before then. But in the meantime, thanks for joining us today, Guy.
Well, thank you.